In the Biz News Sports Show this week, we have rugby legend John Smith with us. And Rory Steyn, you invited John to join us this week. What was your thinking behind it?
Well, Alec, very simply, the fact that John is a South African, not just a Springbok sporting legend. And the greatest compliment that I can pay to Smitty is that he's just one of those blokes who's never changed. Not that I knew him before he became a Springbok and Springbok captain and record-breaking, you know, Springbok captain and all of those accolades that we know about the man. But he's just been a regular bloke. I know him really more through cycling. I have a cycling charity, as you know, and every time I've asked Smitty to contribute, it's just been no problem at all. One day, one night, we did a night ride, and he was sick. And he had every reason to just call up and say, listen, man, I'm struggling with flu, I can't come. But he pitched, and he was as good to, you know, good as his word. And I just respect that about anybody. You know, I always say, because I suppose my benchmark is Madiba, and I hope it doesn't sound arrogant, gentlemen, but when I say often that people don't impress me, because that's where the bar is. But when a man, you know, says I'm going to pitch up and he's ill and he still pitches, I respect that. So yeah, that's how I know John. And he's just he's one of us. He's a South African legend, but he's got his feet on the ground. Appreciate that about you, John.
We've got a lot to ask him about. And given that he's like you, he's in a similar business. And I just want to tell, because Biz News is about business and our guys all know the business world. But John is the CEO of a pretty substantial company, which was started by the CEO and founder of MvelaServe, which was listed on the JSE. To be running that business, the business that you do, SSG Holdings, John, and you've been doing it for 5 years now, has given you insights into business that I'm really keen to tap into when it comes to this Ackerley deal and the revised Ackerley deal, etc. And then, of course, what's happening with the Sharks? Are they going to get, you've played for the Sharks for so many years, and you knew you ran the Sharks for a few years as well. So, Rory, you've really made a great call, I think, in getting the legend onto our program today. You want to kick off with the first question about this Ackerley deal, because we've discussed it also with Rob Herzog, but from a different angle of the way that the it seems as though there were some third parties who were going to make a heck of a lot of money as commissioned agents.
Well, it's not my forte, as you both know, Alec, but I do have a question, funnily enough, because I've been reading it and following it, because I'm very interested, just as a South African rugby supporter. So my question would be whether John has heard anything about Johan Rupert and his consortium's involvement, because that to me makes a whole lot more sense than selling the family silver. And I know that's an overused cliche now, but why would we sell the family silver to an outside entity when we've got proper investors in the country, you know, Rob Herzog and Johan Rupert and many others included in that? So what have you heard, Smitty?
This has been such an ongoing lengthy process. And to remember, the first deal was actually CVC, and we're certainly not the first to sell equity. And I think that's probably the biggest faux pas in this whole, I guess, 4-year period, if it's not more. Everyone thinks we're selling a portion of the Springboks, but it's actually not an equity deal. It's a 20% stake of our commercial rights. So it's not selling the Springboks, it's not selling the business, it's just selling the commercial value of what the brand of the Springboks is able to produce. And at the moment, their brand value is probably at its all-time high, but it's still not producing enough to be able to sustain SA Rugby. That's the reality. I mean, the cost of rugby has gone through the roof, and just to a point where we've got 12 Tier 1 nations, and 11 of those 12 nations make a financial loss every year. So I think people sometimes get the wrong impression around rugby and where it stands from a commercial point of view, and that I think is what this deal was trying to do. Two things: it was trying to fix, a cash flow problem from a South African rugby point of view. There was a massive loss in expected income from Lions series, which never materialized. So any kind of profit or I guess cash injection we were hoping to get didn't materialize. And so that then further exacerbates the financial problem. And then the equity deal started to happen. Locally, primarily with the franchises, and then internationally, we started to see deals happen with the All Blacks, I think, who were, you know, in the one of the first teams to go down that road. And then we've seen equity deals in and amongst tournaments as well, largely in the Northern Hemisphere. So it's important to understand it's not selling 20% of the Springboks. And I think that's where it was probably misrepresented in terms of the actual structure of the deal. The involvement of local businesses and consortiums, absolutely. I mean, that would be ideal. That would be position A. And I think when this was made, you know, when we were as a SA Rugby Council, when we started to realize we were going down this road, it gets communicated across the board to all the franchises, all the unions. Remember, the SA Rugby Council is primarily just a servant to the 14 unions. We work for the 14 unions. We represent their interests. And no matter what decision we make, we can only get any action by having a majority vote of the 14 unions. For me, the interesting thing is, you know, when we presented this opportunity of going for equity and trying to find a partner, there was every opportunity in the world for anyone locally to jump in and say, well, let's have a go. But there was none of that. There was no local option. And then when we went down the CVC road, and we obviously that didn't materialize, and then we got into the Ackley Group, you know, all of this was communicated. And I only know this because I sit in the council. All of this was communicated to all of the presidents and all the CEOs of the 14 unions. And again, still nothing around why can't we participate? So it's strange, obviously, that the initial Ackley deal was rejected because they wanted to have some local presence. But there was every opportunity in the beginning, I think, you know, it's a difficult one. But like, I can't talk too much around the detail, obviously, as a council member. But it's a position where we do need to do something in SA Rugby to be able to sustain what probably is one of the biggest givers of hope and success and championship material that we have, which is the Springboks. And it's got such amazing brand and history in terms of where it came from, and the fact that it was such a divisive team that now really is such a massive tool in terms of success and bringing people together. We need to be able to, as a council, try and sustain that game. And at the moment, it's difficult from a commercial point of view to think around what happened around COVID and the lack of funds. So where we end up, I guess we're still finding that out. People have got a lot to say around the commissions that have been paid. And you made mention of that, I think, at Alec. And I mean, it's crazy. I think, and I guess I've had the fortunate privilege of being both in business and in sports administration, but you know, paying commissions are standard. If anyone brings you a deal, there's going to be some kind of commission. So I think what I find bizarre is how people moan about commissions being paid. And again, there's a lot to unpack there. But this one is probably a sizable one, you know, bearing the fact that this was brought in through a chap that works in Formula One, where commissions are up to 20%. So I think it's. It's one thing to pay 10 rand of 100 rand, but it's when it's 10 million of 100 million, then all of a sudden the percentage becomes irrelevant because the number of the commission is such a big one. I think that's probably what's made people a little bit uneasy around the commission. But to get away from paying commissions means that no one will ever bring you any deals. You know? So again, I'm really going at a high level on the commission problem, but it is something that it has definitely blocked any deal that's tried to be done so far.
John, one of the issues on the commission, I think, is the guy who's involved there, Brian Mahan, who's got a very, very spotty record, to put it mildly, in South Africa. He was very involved with Styx Marewa and Danny Jordan and the whole soccer stories, which I know from personal experience. I had a little brief time at ABSA, and I think that's sent a lot of alarm bells ringing. But anyway, it is what it is, and you've explained it very well. I did omit to say that you've been on that board for quite some time. What's the expertise like of the executive committee at SA Rugby?
Certainly has changed quite a bit. I think this is into my sixth or seventh year on the council, and I have only, my seat there is an independent one, so I don't have any voting power or saying power, purely just there to observe and to give an opinion on certain topics. My seat is provided by the my players, which is representing the players' interests. So in a sense, I'm wearing two caps, one for SA Rugby and one obviously to make sure that the interests of the players are looked after as well. And I think this is my last year, actually, that I'm allowed to be. I've done my first term of 4 years and then had to finish up on someone else's term for the last sort of year or two. So the expertise, there's some really good people there, and we make good decisions. But I guess democracy is always – can be a good and a bad thing, but we come up with some really good ideas in terms of what to present in terms of the direction of rugby, but everything we decide has to be voted in, and so sometimes that can be quite frustrating, but that's the one thing that I guess it's like politics, I guess, and that's what I guess we are, the politicians of rugby, because we're not there, we're not supposed to be there for ourselves, we're there to represent 14 home unions, and we're there to represent the best of what SA Rugby is. So it doesn't matter how much we think we're on the right track. We are at the power of the 14 years to give us a majority vote that allows us to be able to make these decisions. And so we're always at the check. So any decision you see being made is only because we've got the majority of the 14 members to be able to back us. So from that point of view, it's a slow moving wheel, but I think there's a lot of people watching. So our council has improved dramatically in terms of the skill set. We've got some really smart people there as well. It's really diverse as well. So we've got very different opinions and perspectives on the game as well. So it's been an interesting couple of years. I'll tell you one thing. It's a thankless job, rugby administration.
Before we move off this onto subjects of which really are the focus of this, what do you suggest then to the South African public on this? Do we just sit back and watch and know that there are people like John Smith and others with integrity, with the best interests of the country and the sport at heart, who aren't going to sell the box down the river?
That is a very good question. And my message, I think, well, the answer to that question, Alec, would be, I mean, I think that the public are always going to be interested. This is a game that garnered a huge amount of interest. And purely because of one thing, because of how the Springboks perform. And the interest doesn't waver, whether they're winning two World Cups in a row or whether they're losing six games in a row, and we've been in both sides. The interest is high always, whether we're winning or losing. You know? So I think it's very difficult to get a true perspective as the general public around the state of rugby administration. It's far easier to gauge how the teams are playing. And that, I guess, is through the franchises and the provinces and the national side. But if it's, I don't know if this is going to give them hope or make them relax or more stressed, but rugby administration across the world is not perfect, and it hasn't been. When we won in 95 and 2007, 2019, 2023, I'm just talking specifically about South Africa, but I don't think we've ever had the perfect scenario, the perfect setup, the perfect board, the perfect plan. And yet the thing that helps teams win, and I could say probably the same for New Zealand. New Zealand probably could argue that they could create a better administrative plan or strategy. But in spite of non-perfection in administration and of rugby, and I'm guessing of sport, the only thing that really matters is whether or not you can get the right talent to perform the right way. And we have an amazing amount of talent. And at the moment, we've got a coaching staff that has the ability to get them to perform at a peak level, that is at a higher level than the opponents. And that should be the thing that people should struggle with, to try and understand administration in sport, I guess, as a whole. That's a minefield of frustration.
So, Alec, that's maybe a good segue, because I've had a kind of opinion knocking around in the back of my head, and it's this. Why, when we've got the Springboks performing at such a superb level, and those same players then break down into essentially four URC franchises? I mean, I know that there's a handful of guys playing in Japan and a few in Europe. But why can, at franchise level, why do we not see the same level of success as what the Bucks are producing on a global level? And that's maybe a great way, to segue into this coming weekend's rugby. Is it purely a coaching thing? Because as Smitty says, it takes a whole lot more. It takes a whole universe and an ecosystem to get players to perform optimally. Do you have any comment on that, John?
Rory, there are a couple of things, so let's just take the absolute. There's a vast difference between a franchise team and a Springbok team. So the Springbok coaching staff have got their team, and they've got access to them through Regulation 9 at the same times as every other coach. And so the accessibility is only limited to one thing: injuries. So that's the only thing that they have to contend with from an international point of view. Whereas a franchise coach who's now got to compete at the URC and obviously now the Investec Champions Cup, is he's got to deal with the fact that he's got his Springboks, and maybe he's got not enough, just the right amount, too many, but they're in and out. So there's traffic there. And that always creates this difficulty in terms of a culture and momentum and rhythm of a franchise. And it was the same in our day, but probably less so. Now we can choose from South African international players playing across the world. But a lot of them have come back to South Africa because we've got this equity, these four teams that are allowing for them to come play back in South Africa. So there's a lot more disruption and there's a lot more decision-making to be done. Now, put yourself, Rusty and his team have got one thing. They've got to win 15 games a year. It doesn't matter whether they're playing a tier three country or the All Blacks. You know, there's an expectation to win 15 out of 50. So yes, we want to win the Champions Cup and we would love to go unbeaten in the year tour. But in a sense, it's a simple game plan. Your plan is to win every game you play. And I can tell you, every coach and player in the world wants to win every game they play. But the franchise coaches have got a slightly different challenge. They've got two, sometimes three tournaments. And again, some of them have got more than one coach, but they've got to go, Currie Cup, then they've got URC, and then they've got the Investec Champions Cup. And I don't think that even with our equity ownership, and even if you look at the sort of squad depth of the Sharks, there's not a team that I think can operate and compete and win all three of those. So then coaches go, well, for me to survive, I got to pick one or two. And most of them go pick one. And at the moment, I think, and it was probably... we're probably going to get to that in terms of the Investec Champions Cup. And there's been a lot of criticism from the North around our approach in the first round and the results. And rightly so. The Investec Champions Cup is the greatest tournament, rugby tournaments, from a club point of view in the world. I played in it for two teams, for Clermont and for Saracens. And it's like the best of the best. You're playing these clubs in France that have got players from around the world. And it's just, it's a top tournament. It's a tough tournament. And so when you start seeing some of our big franchises sending, I would say watered down is probably the right term without creating too much of a fuss, but not full throttle teams, it's going to irritate the Champions Cup, because the Champions Cup's only ever been about whether you're an English club resting players in the Premiership so that you've got your best team to go to the Investec Champions Cup. That's the sort of narrative around all the clubs that are playing in that league. Exactly. Investec Championship Cup is the ultimate. Everything sits beyond. But our coaches are under a little bit more pressure, and especially because this URC is actually taken off much faster. People have gotten into it a lot faster because we've had a lot more success in the URC than we had in Super Rugby. Because we are playing at there's a lot less travel in terms of being away from home for 5 weeks, although that's also now becoming... it's going back to that. Guys are spending more time in the Northern Hemisphere, and there's this competitiveness. We are far more successful and more competitive in the URC than we were in Super Rugby. And again, I am I feel for the coaches that are applying locally, but we should be competing. We look at the squad depth and probably cost of the Sharks and the Bulls. There are two teams that could that have the potential to win the Investec Champions Cup. But you've also got two back, and we can take the Sharks for example. They played in two competitions. They won two competitions last year. But yet, you still feel like there's this pressure for them to perform. And it's only because you look at their roster, their lineup of players, and you look at what they've potentially got to pick from. And no one ever looks at who's injured and who has to rest because they've played test matches. But you naively just look at what they've got on contract and you think, okay, well, maybe there's like Toulon, Toulouse, Saracens, those kinds of teams that can compete in that level. But it's difficult. Plum's got to be able to. You've got two trophies last year. He's thinking, okay, well, I need a trophy this year, if not two trophies. It's very risky to put all your eggs in the Investec Champions Cup basket as a South African franchise coach, because invariably you're going to have to take a risk in URC. And now URC, you've got to go top eight so that you can get back the next year. So it's cutthroat. I promise you, South African coaching a franchise, it's a tough gig.
John, when so I have a look for that, and I have a look ahead, at the Eric. At the teams that are competing against the South African sides in the Investec Champions Cup, they're almost like a rest of the world put together. You have players from all over, the best of the best. And our teams are primarily South African based or local boys. They're the sprinkling of foreigners who've been brought in. Does this not have to change for us to be competitive? And really where I'm going on this, the Investec Champions Cup seems to be a little bit like the European Cup, where the best of the best in Europe get together on the football side, and you know if you win that, it's the ultimate. You beat Real Madrid. In rugby, our guys have been kind of jumped into this incredible tournament. It's like Kaizer Chiefs and Orlando Pirates playing in the European Cup, and they would not take it lightly. And it seems as though they certainly would take a little while to adjust. Are we in a similar situation? And indeed, with the Rand being so weak as against the strong currencies up north, could we ever be in a position where we could compete properly?
Your currency will always play a role, I think. But let's get to your first part of the question. It's a valid one. I think there is... It's without a doubt, the teams that have competed and won the Investec Champions Cup in the past have been teams that have got a very big player budget. Normally, there's no sort of salary cap. And if there is, there's a sort of a vague gray line around what that salary cap is. And they're also paying in euros and pounds. And so South Africa has got two challenges. And I think this is why I think we've underestimated it. As a South African public, we've underestimated the challenge of the Investec Champions Cup is because you take the clash this weekend between Toulouse and the Sharks. I mean, that Toulouse team, they've got a big budget. It's a proper rugby team, one of the best club teams in the world and has been for a long time. And when they want a fly half, they go and get a Luke McAllister. In our time, that was the guy that was playing fly. They go find him All Black or a Wallaby or the best English guy. They just... the best that they have outside of what they can produce locally. So, and that's what makes it so special. You're right. These are barbarian teams that are coming from France and coming from England, but there's a conglomeration, and to make matters worse, there's a sprinkling of South Africans that have gone and plied their trade there as well that compete to the same tournament. So, yeah, I think we are going to be under the pump when it comes to being able to pay for the players to come back to South Africa. B, we've got to contend with the South African players that are earning a wage overseas. But the reality is South Africa got 51 guys that played test rugby in 2004. And I know a lot of those guys ply their trade overseas. We have got a massive amount of talent at the moment that should allow for the Sharks and the Bulls and the Stormers and the Lions. The Lions, you've actually got to take your head off them, your hat off, because you look at how they're probably the smallest budget of the four franchises and how they perform and what they can produce. Now, theirs in itself is for you as biz news, that's a conversation to have in terms of how affected they've been with so much less than the other three franchises. But we've got enough talent to be able to compete at an international level against these barbarian teams with the kind of players that we've got currently. And so, yes, the Sharks, to us, look like on paper, they should wipe the floor with Toulouse. But there's no chance. Toulouse has won that tournament 3 or 4 times, maybe more. And they've got international stars. They've got one of the best players in the world at 9. I mean, we are under pressure to be able to win at home against Toulouse. So that's the reality. And I think sometimes we lose perspective about how just competitive this is. There's teams in that I played in the Investec Champions Cup. There's club teams there that will beat teams in the top 5 international teams in the world. That's how good they are. So this is not Currie Cup. This is not Super Rugby. This is not URCU. This is a different level.
John, I know that you're struggling to hear Rory accurately, but in essence, just to paraphrase that question, Rory, is that he's asking if it is possible for South African teams to ever really compete unless the big guys from Europe send second string sides to play here, let alone our guys not being able to send second string sides to Investec Challenge Cups, but fixtures. But in fact, sometimes that we might get the boot on the other foot. And it gets back to the second part of the question I asked earlier about the role that those big budgets and the hard currency plays and what it would take for South Africans to really be competitive?
I'd say currently, yes, we certainly can compete. You look at, again, we'll reference the Toulouse versus Sharks game this weekend. And, you know, the Sharks have got the ability to choose more than 15 players out of 23 that have represented South Africa internationals. You know, so there's no reason why they shouldn't be able to compete against Toulouse, which also is a team that has many international representatives. You know, I think where the difficulty starts to come is when you look at some of the other cycle franchises that don't have as many international players. Then it's that's tricky. You look at, you know, it's a big ask to be able to compete in that international tournament. So teams like the Sharks and the Bulls and the Stormers to a degree have got a fair amount of Springboks because of the fact that we had 51 guys represent South Africa last year, currently do have the ability to compete against the best clubs in the world. And that might change. You know, we might have a player exodus that, you know, that goes and plays overseas again, and then that sort of does restrict it. But South Africa has this amazing ability to continue to find talent, the schooling system and this turntable and this pipeline of players that keeps coming through. So, yeah, I do believe that we have teams, especially right now, that can compete against the likes of Toulouse.
So essentially it's going to be our talent.
Kyle's team.
Correct. That's pretty much the bottom line. Look, don't get me wrong, Alec. Our guys aren't going hungry at the end of the month. But it does come down to that.
Rory's wanting to know about what it's going to take to balance, if you don't have a budget, to actually balance the advantages that a Toulouse or Leinster would have against the South African franchises. And I'd love you to just share a little bit of your background with Saracens, for instance. At the time that they were top of the European pops, they were also incredibly well-funded and wonderful teams that Saracens have pulled out there, John. And people in South Africa haven't been following any of this. And so as a result, don't realize that Saracens captain Brad Barrett was one of the European greats. And here he's a local boy who ended up playing for England. Just be interesting to get some insights from you on that side that is a bit invisible to most of us here.
Yeah, I think therein lies the tricky part. I played in the Investec Champions Cup for two teams. One was Clermont-Ferrand in France just after the World Cup in 2007, and obviously the other was for Saracens just after the World Cup in 2011. And two very well-funded teams. You know, it was probably what made me choose Clermont over Toulouse, you know, in terms of teams, was the quality of the squad. And then Saracens also, you know, this amazing group of players. And from the notes, I think the one thing around how to get it right is, and you can buy anyone you want. You can have as much money as you want, and you can buy the best players in the world, and it doesn't guarantee you results. And so the balance really is, you've got to buy sometimes the best players, but sometimes the good players who actually are also good people that fit into the culture of the club. And that's only really possible at clubs that have a very strong, successful culture, where it's team before individual. And so a lot of these teams that spend a lot of money end up allowing their culture to be altered, where it's rock star above team. And so you can spend as much money as you want and we'll have all the rock stars in the world, but if you don't have a team that has the ability to create synergy that makes them collectively better than what they are as individuals, you can spend three times as much. It's still not going to help you. And so Saracens probably and Clermont were good examples. I think we had probably one of the best squads in the French league, and we had certainly one of the best squads in the Premiership. And with Saracens had the ability to get all these great players that they contracted to buy into the Saracens way. And that was what it was called. It was the Saracens way. And they actually played big players from other clubs wanted to get contracted to the Saracens way because of this energy and this vibe. And a lot of it was irritating to every other club member because Saracens almost arrogantly went about their business. We had a huge amount of fun. And flip, the only thing that was expected of us was to work when we were on the field, which was 12% of our time of the week. That was the sort of crux of what Saracens made Saracens successful. 12% of the week is what we need you to work. The rest, have as much fun, develop yourself. We'll help you develop. We'll get you into studying something, doing photography. We'll take you on trips around the world and on weekends off. I mean, we went into an Investec Champions Cup game after having 4 days in Cape Town and then flying back on a Thursday to play Champions Cup on a Saturday. And I'll never forget, I was made captain that day and we were down at halftime and I was like, geez, guys, we have to pull our fingers here, because if we lose this game, we're never going to go on another cool trip again. So probably not my greatest Braveheart speech, but it worked incredibly well. The guys eventually called their way back to win an Investec Champions Cup game after the back end of a four-day pretty much party in Cape Town to break up the winter. So that's the real difference. Yes, budget helps, and every coach is going to want more money and more players, but it's the coaches that understand how to spend their money and that doesn't threaten their culture. And so it's the established coaches and the established clubs that are able to spend money, that have a culture that a big name rocks up and has to fit into. But when you don't have that, that's when the tricky part comes. So invariably there'll be teams where you go, look at that lineup. I mean, how do they lose? And there you've probably got, you know, maybe inexperience, the team hasn't been together a long time, or maybe the coaching staff hasn't been there a long time. And there's just not enough history of a culture that puts the team before the player. And then you've got trouble. And so that for me is the balance, is around you can, and the South African teams, and I'll use the Lions as an example. They're a prime example of the smallest budget that produce, I think, the most consistent results. They've got a group of guys there that play for each other and for a coaching staff, and they back each other and they create something together that's far better than they would have done as individuals. And that's where the balance lies. Is when you want to win cups and tournaments, you've got to have really good players that are also nice guys that also put their own ambitions behind that of the organizations. And that's the tricky part.
I'm so glad you brought that up, John. And before we let you go, I did meet with Saracens during the spell I had in the UK, and I went through the whole Saracens way, and it was eye-opening. The closest thing that I've seen in South Africa of learning from, and essentially, effectively, what the CEO told me was that they, and I'm sure you must have done this yourself, would go out to corporations and tell corporations about the Saracens way, and the corporates would pay lots of money to hear how the team had been structured there. Another point that I'd just love to get your views on, Tim Noakes, who's well known as a great international science figure. His son-in-law, John Dobson, is the coach of the Stormers. And Tim is a great believer in learning from other parts of the world. And he picked up insights from the legendary coach of the 49ers, San Francisco 49ers. And he and John Dobson have studied this guy. And I'm not going to mention his name because I don't want to give too much away. I don't know how much was given in confidence. But they've used a lot of those learnings from the most professional sport in the world, if you talk about financial terms, to inject into what's going on at the Stormers. And the Stormers do appear, until this season anyway, to have outperformed on that basis. Is that kind of a template for the future, the combination of the Saracens way and maybe learning from other sports and other areas to overcome the issue that Rory was explaining about lack of budget, having to balance your allocation of resources better, being like you in a business, everything to you in business is allocating resources correctly, and perhaps rugby unions are going to have to fast track that for South Africans to become as competitive as we all want them to be.
Alec, I think the question actually relates across both spheres in business and in sport. And it's not just rugby, but it's every organization that competes for, whether it's for an EBITDA or for a for profit margins, for titles, everyone needs to have good people. So the right people doing the right job that enjoy what they do. So, you know, that's always the tricky part. So you get people that are passionate about what they view, what they're doing. And you then got to manage how much you spend on these people. So that obviously affects the bottom end in terms of profits at the end of the day. And you've got to be able to pull them together so that like a team, that they can then create something that's brilliant. And if you get that all right, and you make a record profit or you win every title in the year, it only gets harder the next year because then everyone else is learning from you and watching what you do. And I think probably our Springbok team is probably an example of that with Rossi and his team. You know, they've changed the way they've played almost on an 18-month basis. There's been these cycles of introducing different things and innovating all the time, because the horrible thing about achieving your goal is that everyone's looking at how you got there and copying it and trying to do it better. So if you continue to do it, you invariably don't win anything the next season and you don't make the same profits the next year in your business. So if you're not continually looking at innovating and different ways of generating income as a rugby team, or a different way of playing, so that if someone starts to figure out what you're good at, by the time they've got it right, you're already onto the next different style of play. It's the same in business. So that in essence is the key to success for any coach, CEO, general manager, chairman. These are the challenges and these are the things that make CEOs and coaches stay longer in their roles, because they're able to learn from others as they're on the way up and then innovate to stay on the top while others are learning from them. But even when you're winning, if you're not paying attention to the opposition and not looking at other organizations to learn about different tricks and different things, you're also going to stagnate.
John Smith, it's been such a pleasure talking with you today. John's the CEO of SSG Holdings, one of the leading security and other services operations. Lovely to be talking to you about rugby and business. And we will continue now with Rory into the future with the weekend's games. But John, thanks. We've taken a lot of your time. And until the next time, look forward to chatting with you.
I like that background you've now got there, Rory. Where exactly are you?
I'm in Gqeberha. You know that it's the wonderful SA20 league, the Betway SA20. Tonight is the opening match at the home of the defending champions, the two-time defending champions, by the way, Sunrisers East. No, we didn't need that, did we?
Becha doesn't seem to have the best air at the moment, if that's how it's treated. Maybe it's some of that dirty Gauteng air that you took down there. But was that a good chat there with John Smith a bit earlier?
Wonderful chat with John Smith. But well, you know, what a lovely bloke. You know, apart from his status up there in the pantheon of South African rugby legends. I mean, he's one of only three of our captains to win those four Rugby World Cups. And sometimes, you know, people always think about 95 because of the Mandela factor. And of course, now we've got Sia and Rassi. But people don't realize that Jake White and John Smith did a fantastic job with a really superb team. I mean, they beat England 36-0 in that opening game and then went and did them again in the final, even though Johnny Wilkinson had come back in France. But he's just the nicest bloke. Alec, he's got his feet on the ground. Whenever I've asked him to do something, and I've come to know him not through rugby, but through my cycling charity, the African Icons. And, you know, he's always just been, yeah, no problem. You know, what can I do? I got to know him and his wife, Roxy. I mean, they're not close mates. We're not braying every weekend. But I genuinely like the guy because he's just kept his feet on the ground despite his stature, both as a player now in the media. You know, he's got his own media thing. And he's the group CEO of a very successful facilities company, you know, SSG. So I like him.
Mm. Yeah, Ed, those who wouldn't know is that we had quite a few technical issues and he was very calm and relaxed, and you can imagine what his diary looks like, and yet he was very measured in his conversation with us. Something that I'll always remember John Smith for, he was the captain of the team that beat the Lions.
Correct.
If you recall that Mornay Steyn, it was in 2009, the Mornay Steyn penalty that won the game for us and won the series for us at Loftus. And I was there with one of my dearest, dearest friends who passed away very shortly afterwards, who was a mad rugby fan. And he said, the one thing I want to see before I die is we've got to beat the Lions. And he was there on that day, and John Smith was the captain of the team. So very personal for lots of people. But Mornay was amazing. I mean, Mornay Steyn, he won that against the Lions. He won the next one against the Lions as well, if you remember that last minute.
Yes, kick. And then when he did it again,
incredible.
That COVID series, the memes the next day were, don't worry, when the Lions come back, Mornay Steyn will only be 49 years old, and we'll bring him up.
We got to talk to him sometime. We also got to talk to the Lions, the Gauteng Lions. I loved what John said about the art performance that they've had. But we're going to end this sports show by going through your forecast, your predictions for the weekend's rugby, starting with your the team that you support above all others, and we know why. Kyle's team, Glasgow Warriors, big game tonight.
Big game.
Tomorrow night, tomorrow, Friday.
And it opens up the weekend of the first of two weekends of Investec Challenge Cup, Champions Cup rugby. So they're hosting Racing 92 from Paris, the team that Sia was brought back from to the Sharks. And I think Glasgow have got enough in the tank. And again, you know, this conundrum that we speak about every week, Alec, about what team will Racing bring? Are they going to bring full strength or an understrength team? We don't know. I looked for the team lineups before I spoke to you, couldn't find all of them. But I think that Glasgow have got this by 8 points.
8 points, okay. Then the first local team to take on the internationals is the Stormers against the Sail Sharks at 3 o'clock on Saturday afternoon. This has got to be one that the Stormers must be eyeing to win.
No, they've got to win this. It's of course going to be wonderful if they play. And again, what team are Sail going to travel with? They've got a win and a loss, but to have the three Dupreer brothers playing at the DHL Stadium in Cape Town would be pretty cool. But for the reason that you said, the Stormers have lost two out of two, so they've got to pull up their socks. I think that's, you know, post all of those unbelievably terrible injuries that they've endured, they're on the up and up. Perhaps they've sorted out a few other issues, you know, within the camp. I don't know, but it looks that way. So I'm going Stormers to beat the Sail Sharks by 10 points, Alec.
You'll go John Dobson. And then the next game between the Exeter Chiefs and Bordeaux. Your call there?
Bordeaux, first team that I'm calling as an away team win. the way that they played in the top 14, where they rested a couple of players, indicates that they're going to go to England with a full strength lineup. So I'm saying Bordeaux away win by 7.
It just shows what John Smith was saying as well, that this is the major, the premier, the biggest tournament in the world. And the French know how to play it. As you say, they rest their first team guys in the domestic fixtures and all to put it in on the weekend. Then to the next game, the big game of the weekend, the Sharks against Toulouse. Listening to John, the Sharks have got it all to do.
I agree with him. And you're quite right. This is undoubtedly the game of the weekend. And then there's been a little bit of chatter on our BizNews sports group as well about the fact that DuPont has only played a few minutes of rugby in the Southern Hemisphere. Every indication would look, would indicate that they're coming with their full strength team. A whole lot of them. So, you know, there are lineups like DuPont against whichever of our Sharks, Springbok, Scrum-offs, Plumtree selects. You've got Itzebet up against Moafu. You've got Mbonambi up against Movaka. And I think that Toulouse will come with a full strength team. And I think that possibly even if they don't, I think Toulouse are going to be too strong for the Sharks. Sharks, go prove me wrong. Pick your Springboks and prove me wrong, but I think Toulouse are going to win by 3.
Ramos doesn't miss, the fullback. We know that. He just doesn't miss. And the Sharks they seem to be struggling to put the ball over from their kicks. So if they can't get that right, it's going to be a heck of a game. But it does appear as though they've got a lot to do, the Sharks. Who knows? Talent against money. But it feels to me a little bit like, forgive me, but Leicester at home to Liverpool. You hope that Leicester can do it, but Liverpool are probably too strong in that one from a soccer parlance. Munster and Saracens, Rory.
A very, very tough one to call, I found, Alec. Munster, they're also in that kind of no man's land where they've won one and lost one, and Saracens have won both. But I think Saracens are likely to come across with very close to a full strength, if not their, you know, all of their England internationals and others. I mean, they've got other internationals that play for Saris. But I'm going with Munster here. I think that Munster are they've been warming up for a while. They've been a little bit indifferent, which is surprising for them. But Thomond Park is a very, very difficult place to go to. And I'm going to say in a very tight game, possibly to and fro, Munster by 2.
With the assumption that Munster does play its best team.
Correct. Yeah, no, I think they will. Alec, at home, are they going to do that? Yeah.
Stade Francais against the Northampton Saints, who beat the Bulls. We watched that game at Loftus, felt that the Bulls threw it away. I'm not sure if you agree with that, but it's a very classy team, the Saints, Northampton Saints.
No, they are. They're defending premiership champions, and credit to their coaching staff. You know, they decided one up front, they're going to use the away game in South Africa to bring their whole squad out and to play a full strength team. And I really think the tournament needs that thing. We don't have to have these, you know, you don't have to qualify all of your predictions by, it depends on which team they pick. You know, I wish they'd pick a full strength team every week, every team. And Stade Francais I don't think that they necessarily take this tournament seriously enough. I think that they're struggling a bit, so they are more concerned about the top 14. I could be wrong, but I think this is the second one of the away teams that are going to win this. So I think Northampton Saints by 5 in Paris.
Castro Olympique against the Bulls. Can the Bulls pull it off?
No, I don't think so. Bulls are notoriously poor tourists. Bulls, go prove me wrong, please. But I'm saying Bulls are coming off 2 losses, and Cast there are one of each. I'm saying Cast Olympique by 6.
Leicester Tigers against Ulster.
Leicester by 15. I think this is one that's possibly a little easier to call. Ulster have lost both of theirs. Of course, they're going to go across there with some Northern Irish fire in their bellies, but I think that the boys there are going to be too strong for them. Yeah, Leicester by 15.
That's Andre Pollard's team, of course. And then Toulon Harlequins.
Got to be Toulon, hey? They've got two wins out of two. They're always good at home. Harlequins are a win and a loss. But Toulon is after Toulouse and Bordeaux, your next two big French clubs are Toulon and La Rochelle. And I'm going Toulon by 10 there, Alec.
Bristol Bears versus Benetton. Could the Italians pull off a shock?
They could, but I expect them not to, because Bristol Bears have lost both of their games so far. Now they've got a home match, and they're looking at Benetton as possibly an opportunity to pick up their first four or hopefully 5 points. So I'm going Bristol Bears by 11 over Benetton.
Stade Rochelais against Leinster. Here's a biggie.
That's a big game. That's a very, very big game. And the second one that's very, very difficult to call, Alec. But, you know, La Rochelle at home, they are big, big, big men. That's Will Skelton's team. What's the big French tight head? The 145-kilogram tight head. His name just escapes me now. He's in there with Will Skelton scrumming behind him. And both teams are on two wins out of two. And Leinster are, as you know, as close to Ireland as you can get. And they're very, very competitive. Now, here's the thing about this fixture, Alec. In the when it was still the Heineken Cup 2 years ago in Dublin, they were it was played at Dublin's home ground. Even though it's finals are played at a neutral venue, Leinster made the final, so it was in all senses of the word a Leinster home game, and they were leading. Ronan O'Gara as their coach leading that game right up till the last about 10 minutes. Ronan O'Gara coaches an Irishman, coaches La Rochelle, and Leinster were leading up until about the last 10 minutes, and the Irish coach for the opposition somehow got La Rochelle over the line. So this is a bit of a revenge match. That's the first thing I need to say. But it's very, very hard to call this one. I'm going to back the home team. I'm going to say La Rochelle by 3 over Leinster.
So some really good rugby coming up. But the last one is John Smith's old record, to put it mildly. Travel to Bath.
Notoriously not good on the road. Again, don't know what team Clermont are going to choose. But although Bath are doing exceptionally well in the Gallagher Premiership, although they lost by a point the other day, they have got Finn Russell back at 10 and two losses in the Investec Cup, I think, is going to really spur Bath on. So I've got Bath by 14 points over Clermont.
That's quite a win. Rory Steyn, it's been wonderful putting together this week's sports show. Look forward to the next time. Have fun in Qabeja with the cricket and the defending champions.
And may I just say again a big thank you to John Smith for being such a champion, coming onto our show as our first guest with a joint interview with a few technical issues, but just being the ultimate professional. So thank you, Smitty. And have a great weekend of rugby, everybody. Thank you, Alec.
All the best, Rory, and to you. Until the next time, cheerio.